The Democratic Republic of Congo will celebrate 50 years of independence in June, but is there a lot to celebrate? Its history has included assassinations, civil wars, and an oppressive dictatorship, and it continues to be faced with rebel groups and violence throughout parts of the country. Joining me now for an update on the situation in the DRC is John Elliott, Africa Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. I'm very pleased to welcome him to today's second underreported segment. Hi.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Last month, the DRC government rejected charges by Human Rights Watch that in December, the Ugandan rebel group, the Lord's Resistance Army, had killed around 300 people in Mukombo in the northeastern part of the country, and that they had kidnapped about 250 more over the course of 4 days. Why would the government in Kinshasa reject charges against the LRA?
It wasn't just, of course, the Congolese government that rejected the reports. The Ugandan government also rejected them for slightly different reasons. But I think you mentioned in your intro that Congo faces an important milestone this year. It's 50th anniversary of independence. It also faces elections next year, and President Kabila has been trying very hard publicly to reassure Congolese and create the impression in advance of those elections that the situation in Congo was normalizing. So reports like this from the northern part of the country don't help his agenda in that regard and complicate it for him politically.
Is he a popular president?
It's hard to say. I mean, he certainly won the previous elections with a strong degree of public support, particularly in the east of the country, promising to resolve the problems in the east. But also we've seen in recent months an increasing crackdown in Kinshasa against opposing voices. The parliament's powers have been restricted. So that's usually a sign that someone is less popular when they're taking that kind of action.
Do we have any idea what prompted the violence in Mukombo?
Well, our research, I mean, it's a very remote part of northern Congo. It takes a fair amount of time to get there, and communications there are particularly bad, which possibly explains why news of the attack didn't come out earlier. This attack took place in December, but we only found out about it in February.
But there's a UN peacekeeping group posted there, isn't there?
There's a small UN contingent in that part of Congo. It's not in the immediate area of this attack, and the numbers have only been moving in there in small groups in the course of the last 6 months. So it's perfectly conceivable this could have happened without the UN even knowing about it.
The Lord, you go ahead.
Yes, I was just going to say, I mean, the motives for the attack, your question, it looks to us like there were three main motives for it. Firstly, economic, feeding themselves. There was a fairly sizable market town, which was one of the centers of the attack, called Tapili, and the LRA group was particularly looking for items like salt and sugar. So that suggests that they were looking to replenish their food stocks. Also, there was a very clear motive to abduct children. The LRA's shocking record of abducting children between the ages of 10 and 14, usually, in order to brutalize them into becoming combatants for them. They were particularly asking for where the schools were on the route of their attack. And I think, you know, the third objective was to send a message. The attack started on the same day that the Ugandan army began their offensive against the LRA in December 2008. And we suspect that date was not an accident, the fact that they chose the same day a year later to attack this community.
Well, the Lord's Resistance Army isn't based in the DRC. They're from northern Uganda. Why do they even operate in the DRC? Is it a safe haven for them?
Well, they were effectively expelled from Uganda a few years ago and have been basing themselves in the northern Congo area, in that sort of border region. I don't know if your listeners know, but the sort of border region between southern Sudan, northern Congo, and the southeastern part of the Central African Republic, which is a pretty ungoverned space, and they've been basing themselves in that area for the last couple of years.
Now, we were talking about Joseph Kabila when he was elected in 2006. There seemed to be a lot of hope in the international community about the future of the DRC. Have things improved on any level since he took office? Have things stabilized anywhere?
Well, look, I mean, I think one has to have a certain degree of sympathy with anyone who has to govern the Democratic Republic of Congo. That the challenges are so vast, and it's such a vast country with poor communications and effectively a breakdown in governance for for the last 20 years. So anyone governing the country is going to face some very serious challenges. And, you know, we have seen some improvement in some parts of the country in economic terms. Clearly, peace in other parts of, in most parts of Congo has brought a degree of economic progress. But where the conflicts continue, particularly in the east and in the north now with the LRA, we're very far from any kind of stability or normality.
But hasn't he said he wants to get the United Nations peacekeeping forces out of the DRC? Wouldn't that further destabilize his country?
Of course. I mean, there's an element of political gambit going on here. I think, and we think in Human Rights Watch, that President Kabila's gambit is not to have the UN withdraw completely, but to have some kind of symbolic drawdown, a small number of troops leave the country so that he can present this to his electorate next year when he goes to the polls as evidence that things are improving to the degree that the UN can begin to withdraw its troops. But I don't think he realistically expects a complete withdrawal by next year.
United Nations Security Council officials have been planning to visit the DRC this week, but had to delay their plans because of the volcanic ash. What kind of relationship does the UN have with the Congolese government?
The Security Council, of course, and the UN are slightly two separate things, and they have two separate beasts, if you like, with different relationships with the government. The UN agencies on the ground are involved in the sort of operational delivery of peacekeeping and emergency aid and so on. The Security Council is supposed to exercise a degree of oversight of the UN operation, but also to make sure that that President Kabila is also bringing to the table the elements he needs to bring in order to help progress in the country. For example, he needs to make sure that that members of his own army who've been committing human rights abuses against civilians and raping women need to be removed from command and need to be charged. And you know, the Security Council has issued him with a list of five people that they believe should be not only arrested and removed from the army, but also put on trial.
And he's resisting that?
Well, there's been a few cosmetic moves, I think, in one or two cases, to put people under some loose form of house arrest. But we've not seen any real progress towards making sure these people are put in jail. And the message is sent to anyone else in the Congolese army that if you commit rape against women, if you torture people, if you murder people, then you will find yourself in prison.
My guest is John Elliott, Africa Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. We're talking about the DRC on our second underreported segment today. The DRC borders nine other countries, including Rwanda, Uganda, and Sudan, some of the continent's most troubled countries. Is it possible to stabilize a country that's so influenced by its neighbors and their problems?
It's a big task, and that's why we continue to support a strong UN presence in the Congo, because we don't think that this can be done without external help. But very clearly, the problems in neighbors and problems in the Congo itself feed on each other. So we need to be sure to be tackling all of them together. Problems easily transmit across borders in that part of Africa, and if we want long-term stability in the entire region, we need to take that approach.
Well, how much of this is, we are always blaming this sort of thing on the legacy of colonialism, but the DRC is as large as the United States, and the very large African states, the DRC, Nigeria, and Sudan, are all troubled, and I'm assuming it's because they have so many different peoples within their borders.
Well, certainly the legacy of colonialism is ever present in the borders. Tribes and groups were cut in half by arbitrary lines drawn by Western countries, mostly Europeans, of course. So no one can really underestimate the impact that has had on trying to establish a coherent identity within those borders. But Congo is a special example in that respect, because Congolese are very proud people, and there is actually a sense of Congolese identity that you don't find in some other countries in Africa. And, the period during Mobutu Sese Seko's rule was particularly damaging for the country, where what little infrastructure existed declined, what little integration of the economy was blown apart. So Congo has been in better places than it is now, and we have to be optimistic it can get back there.
Although Congo started off with an area seceding under Moise Tshombe.
Yes.
Yep. So it's had this kind of history of I'll come in. Well, Moise Tshombe was really working as a kind of a puppet for other forces.
Yes.
If somebody wants to take advantage of the incredible natural resources of Congo, they'll just go in and start another insurrection, it seems.
Yeah, that's always a risk. And you're right, it's been a roller coaster in Congo since independence in 1960. But those optimists among us have to keep believing, I think, that it can be taken to a better place. And if we lose optimism, then we end up in a very dangerous place for the entire region.
They're also changing alliances. The Democratic Forces mm-hmm. for the Liberation of Rwanda, the FDLR, mm-hmm. is a Hutu rebel group that was supported by the Congolese in the 1990s. Aren't they causing a lot of trouble in the eastern part of the country?
They are indeed. I mean, we brought out a report in December last year about the some massacres committed by both the FDLR, remnant of the genocidaires from Rwanda in 1994, and also by the Congolese army. And in terms of alliances, you're absolutely right. In fact, the Congolese Tutsi rebels, the CNDP, have actually recently been absorbed into the Congolese army and were used to fight the FDLR. So it's a very complex patchwork of, as you say, shifting sands, shifting alliances that doesn't help establish any kind of long-term sense of stability.
Well, 2 years ago, the Rwandan and Congolese governments agreed to try to disband the FDLR. How successful has that operation been?
It's been a failure, and the UN supported that operation, and that was also a failure last year. I think everyone has gone back to learn some lessons from that, which is that if you launch military operations like this in eastern Congo, for example, without looking at the issues of protecting civilians that might be affected by both sides, without looking at more effective means of trying to encourage defections from the FDLR. If you just adopt a one-line military strategy, then you're likely to fail. It needs a much more comprehensive strategy, and with the right resourcing and the right leadership and management, I think, for the right result to happen. So that they're learning some lessons. Unfortunately, the Congolese civilian population in that region, 1 million people were displaced by that action, have taken the brunt of that of those lessons, and we mustn't let that happen again.
Well, how does the general populace of DRC see its military? Earlier this week, there were allegations that the military killed 11 civilians when it retook the airport at Mdandaka from rebels.
So
do people see their own military as almost as dangerous as these rebel groups?
Absolutely, they do. And there are good commanders within the Congolese army, and some units are better than others. So we wouldn't want to get into the game of saying the entire Congolese army is a disaster. There are some people trying to do good things. Unfortunately, there are also so many bad ones, and so many bad actors and commanders not being removed from positions of power, that the civilian population is terrified. And when they find out in advance that a particular unit is coming, it's quite often the case that people will leave their villages and towns and go and stay with relatives elsewhere.
What about aid workers? Earlier this month, 8 International Red Cross workers were kidnapped and then later released, but there have been problems in the past, haven't there?
They have.
Do certain groups prefer this kind of tactic, going after the NGOs?
Well, it happens from time to time, and the motives vary from economic to settling local scores and local pressures. Thankfully, in this occasion in South Kivu, those NGO workers were released unharmed. We have had cases in the past of NGO workers being harmed. But this is sadly what happens when you get very brave, often young people going to dangerous places to do good work. It happens elsewhere in the continent and, frankly, in other parts of the world. It's a risk that people take. But I don't think the pattern has necessarily got any worse in Congo in recent months.
Well, there are estimates that 1,000 women and girls are raped in the DRC each month, and I've heard that sexual violence actually spiked last year. Is it because of increased fighting along the eastern border, or because now there's been some fighting on the western border as well?
That's right. I mean, the situation for NGOs may be unchanged, but the situation for Congolese people is as bad, if not worse. And sexual violence last year spiked in parallel with the military action against the FDLR that the Congolese government and the UN were we're taking on. And you know, it's our experience, I think, and most people's experience, that when you have armed people without effective command, without effective protection of civilians roaming Eastern Congo, then sexual violence is inevitably going to rise. And that was one of our complaints last year about the military action that was taken on.
Are men also targeted with violence?
Men, certainly, yes. I mean, the real problem at the moment, actually, is on that score, is with the LRA. The LRA in northern Congo is particularly targeting men for killings. And we found in our research of the massacre in Makombo in December last year that the vast majority of those killed were adult men. Frankly, I think because they have no economic or other use to the LRA. The LRA prefers children, sadly, and abusing children, and you know, the adults end up being killed as part of their attacks.
What prompted the fighting that began last year in the northwest part of the DRC?
That's still very unclear. We're still trying to get a complete handle on it. It looks a little bit like a mixture of local and national politics, but also some economic reasons. But it's still very unclear, and that unfortunately is the case in many parts of Congo where reporting access is very difficult. We just don't know until you can get people on the ground.
Millions of Congolese civilians have been internally displaced. Hundreds of thousands have fled to neighboring countries. And last year it was estimated that as many as 45,000 Congolese civilians may be dying each month. Does that estimate sound accurate to you?
Well, I mean, it's certainly believable. Estimates of civilians who died during the years of war in the Congo, and the serious years of war in Congo, are up to 5 million. It's been a catastrophe for the entire region for some years, and one can imagine if you have, as we had last year, 1 million people displaced in one part of the country, you uproot people from their villages, children, babies, old people, people who are chronically sick with illness. You can imagine that uprooting them deprives them of the sort of community support that they're used to having, deprives them of medical support, is going to make them more vulnerable.
I've heard reports that the fighting in the Northwest is partly because of fishing rights and may also have a tribal component. Is tribalism still an issue in Congo?
Of course. I mean, when you've got competition for resources and you've got extreme poverty, you're going to get occasional rivalries breaking out based on ethnicity. Also grievances that go back several generations, which is a big problem in the East, of course. So, I mean, it's not unusual, it's not surprising. I think we also have to be careful to not to label everything being tribal in the Congo. There are often short-term and political reasons and people exploiting situations for their own advantage, but one shouldn't be surprised to hear those reports.
We have just about a minute left, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the segment, the DRC will mark 50 years of independence in June. Does the future look as bleak as it sounded during this conversation?
Well, I mean, it's tempting to be pessimistic about the Congo, but those of us who watched the region closely do believe that things can improve, and we do believe it's important to start with those who are responsible for perpetuating the violence and perpetuating the misery that affects the ordinary population. So, as I said earlier, making a start on identifying, charging, and prosecuting those who are most responsible for this misery, for the sexual violence, for the abduction of children, for the torture and the unnecessary use of violence. Starting with them sends a signal all the way down the system that the culture is starting to change.
Although you also might attack the political corruption that has been endemic to the country.
Absolutely, in the same order. There's a nexus between the violence and corruption quite often. While we should always sort of try to deal with the consequences of the violence and, the activities of NGOs to try and help victims of rape and torture and so on is very, very important. We can't neglect going after those responsible for it.
Thank you so much for participating in today's underreported look at the DRC. John Elliott is Africa Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. It's been a kind of a mixed pleasure talking with you.
Yes. But thank you for having me.